This Janet Mufford Today podcast is brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number is 800-793-8752. That's 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org.
This is Janet Mufford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mufford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Well, we are marking yet another anniversary of Roe v. Wade today, the 45th year since the U.S. Supreme Court legalized abortion. And we sometimes also fail to recall that Roe was decided simultaneously with another case, Doe v. Bolton. The court ended up ruling 7-2 that abortion can be legal based on a right to privacy under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. But in fact, there's an awful lot more to the story than most of us probably recall or maybe never even knew at all about how abortion became legal. How did the Supreme Court end up in the abortion debate in the first place? And what should we know about the details behind the decision? We're going to go back into history a little bit today and examine these questions with Roger Russler. Roger is an independent researcher and author of Compelling Interest, The Real Story Behind Roe v. Wade. Roger, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Janet. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's my pleasure. Now, you say the history of abortion as presented in Roe was basically inaccurate and lopsided, and I totally agree. But why do you say that, kind of from a broad perspective?
Well, there's a lot of flaws in Roe, but I think there's probably two major areas that are particularly egregious. One is that this idea that Sarah Weddington advocated that the anti-abortion laws that had come on the books in the late 19th century, her argument was that they were designed simply to protect the woman, that they had nothing to do with protection of fetal life.
Right.
That was number one. And then number two is this whole idea of personhood, that the morality, if you will, of abortion hinges on whether or not we can define a fetus as a person. And of course, if you go down that road, which they did, then the court was free to say whatever it wanted to about whether or not a fetus was a person. And of course, it said that, you know, our conclusion is that the fetus is not a person, therefore abortion is moral. And based on that, we're going to go ahead and allow abortion.
Right, exactly. And there's so much there that you've just said. But Sarah Weddington, obviously, is where the story has to begin. And this was a woman, a lawyer, young lawyer in Texas, who ended up having an abortion of her own. How did that kind of all come together, Roger, as you look back? Because for a lot of listeners, they don't even remember this case. I know I was very young when it was decided. But what was Sarah Weddington's life like? And how did the ball get rolling on the case in the first place?
Well, she was a very bright young lady and wanted to go to law school. She attended law school. And during her time in law school, she became pregnant out of wedlock with her boyfriend, Ron Weddington. And this created a difficult situation for them. Abortion was illegal at that time. People don't really remember that it was against the law to have an abortion unless your life was threatened in the state of Texas, and that's where they were both attending law school. So they decided to try to look around for someone who was willing to perform an illegal abortion. They were not successful in Texas, so they actually went to Mexico, had an abortion there, and came back and finished out their law school and then got married. And then down the road, a couple years from that, Sarah was involved in a liberal group on campus, and one of the things that they were involved in was actually referring other pregnant women for abortions. Again, even though it was illegal in those days, they were making referrals for women who wanted an abortion. And through her contacts with that, it's kind of a long story that I detail in the book, but the short version is that she decided to challenge the Texas law the abortion law after she had graduated, and she had not really held a major job at that point because there were not a lot of opportunities for female attorneys in those days.
Right.
That's just the way it was in the late 60s. And so she devoted herself and a lot of her time to this case, to Roe v. Wade. And they actually had to find a plaintiff in the case who was pregnant and who was seeking an abortion in order to bring a case before the court at that point. So they actively were looking for someone who was pregnant and seeking an abortion. And in those days, again, that was a difficult thing. It wasn't easy to find someone under those conditions, but they eventually found Norma McCorvey. Many people may have heard her name by now.
Yeah.
She actually has since become pro-life, but at the time she was unmarried. She had been pregnant before out of wedlock and had actually given birth prior to that, but she was pregnant again and didn't have a lot of resources, and at a point in her life where she was willing to consider an abortion. And so she met Sarah Weddington and Linda Coffey, and they became her attorneys, and then they filed the case on her behalf.
Yes, right. And you're right. That was very interesting. And it was interesting, too. The woman represented in Doe v. Bolton also ended up becoming pro-life down the road. And that's kind of the irony of it all.
Yes, I think maybe she did. Margie Pittame.
Yeah, it was Sandra Cano. Because I remember talking to her. And that is sort of another one of the things the pro-aborts don't want to really talk about is the fact that some of the main figures in these cases ended up becoming pro-life. But didn't you describe, I think you were quoting somebody in your book referring to Norma McCorvey as something of a sacrificial lamb in the end?
Yes, if I remember right, that was a newspaper article from, a Texas newspaper who acknowledged that, when Sarah Weddington was dealing with Norma McCorvey, she could have referred her for an abortion in the same way that she had an abortion, an illegal abortion,
right,
in Mexico, that was being done. But they didn't do that in her case because they wanted someone who was still pregnant. You couldn't have a court case unless the plaintiff was actually still pregnant and wanting to get an abortion, and she couldn't. So if she already had an abortion, even if it was illegal, well, the case would be moot at that point. There would be no case. So that's why her fellow pro-abortion journalist at that point, who was writing a story about this, indicated that, yes, McCorvey was somewhat of a sacrificial lamb.
Wow.
Because they didn't even try to refer her for an abortion. They wanted to keep her pregnant so that they could have this court case go through. And ironically, Norma McCorvey did not have an abortion.
Yes.
Even after Roe v. Wade, she actually delivered the baby before the case was completed.
Wow.
So she had that baby. She didn't have an abortion.
Yes, very interesting. Well, and it was sort of interesting, too, the fact that this originated out of Texas, because weren't there other states at the time that actually had laws where it wouldn't have served Sarah Weddington as well to have filed in those states?
Right. Again, one of her main arguments was that the laws in the late 19th century had come on the books only as a result of the dangers of illegal abortion at that time. And there was a partial truth to that. Certainly abortion in the late 1800s was definitely very risky for a pregnant woman. You didn't have antiseptics, and it was definitely a dangerous procedure. Obviously it was dangerous for the unborn child.
Sure.
That's a given.
Right.
But it was certainly dangerous for the woman who was seeking an abortion as well. So her argument was that the legislators who created these laws against abortion, and the vast majority of them came on the books in the late 1800s,
Yep. Hang on just a moment. We're going to go to a break and we'll come back. Roger Ressler talking about compelling interest, the real story behind Roe v. Wade. Hang on.
Hi, this is Kirk Cameron, and I am honored to be partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to help moms choose life.
Actor Kirk Cameron supports Preborn.
My four oldest children were adopted. That is because of caring and compassionate people who help those young mothers choose life. My wife is an adopted child, and her birth mother chose life for her. If it weren't for those caring individuals that help those young moms value the sacredness of life, I wouldn't have my wife, I wouldn't have my four adopted children, and the two natural-born children that we have wouldn't exist either. My whole family is here because of people that are involved with ministries like Preborn.
Help moms choose life with Preborn. Your gift of $28 provides an abortion-minded mother a potentially life-saving ultrasound. $140 could save five babies. You can give now at 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229 or visit preborn.com. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. We are taking a look back at the seminal case regarding abortion, Roe v. Wade, 1973, that big decision by the Supreme Court that we're all having to live with, and it's horrific. But we're looking back at this case with Roger Ressler, author of Compelling Interest, The Real Story Behind Roe v. Wade. So we were talking a little bit about Sarah Weddington, Roger, and you were mentioning that, you know, she was going at it from the Texas state law regarding this, you know, the fact that the law was on the books, and she was trying to argue that there were, the only reason that those laws were present was because the primitive, medical practices of the time would be bad for the women and detrimental for the women. But that was not accurate. That was not really the reason, correct?
Correct. I would say that possibly that was the secondary concern, but the main concern, the main reason the laws came on the books in the late 1800s was out of concern for fetal life. And they recognized that the laws were inadequate. Prior to that time, they were based on an archaic notion called quickening, which was when the mother first feels movement inside her womb, then obviously there's a life in there. It's a human life, and that was the only way they had to recognize that there was a life in there, was the first time she felt movement, and that was called quickening. So the laws were based on quickening. After quickening, it was a serious offense to have an abortion. Prior to quickening, it was still considered a misdemeanor to have an abortion, but it wasn't, the law wasn't as serious as it was afterwards.
Right.
So Sarah Weddington's argument was, well, these laws just came on the books in order to protect women from dangerous abortion procedures. But really, and the ironic thing is, if you actually go to the Roe majority opinion and you filter through it, it's long, there's a lot there, but if you will reach a point where Harry Blackmun actually acknowledges that the true reason for the existence of the laws was protection of the fetus.
Mm.
And it's right there in the Roe majority opinion. Most people don't even realize this, and especially pro-choice people that I've discussed this with online are shocked to see that Harry Blackmun actually acknowledges the real reason. for this, but it's actually there in the Roe majority opinion.
Goodness. So the arguments then, when they finally reached the Supreme Court level, the arguments began in 1971. And how did things go? There's a lot there, obviously, that you have to condense, and people can read the book and get the full picture here. But when you look back at just the arguments that were made, what stands out as significant?
Well, I guess what stands out to me overall was just that Sarah Weddington was ultra-prepared and underestimated. She was underestimated by the pro-life attorneys on the other side, and I think that becomes obvious when you listen to the oral arguments. One of the unique things about the book is that it's also in audio form, and in the audio format, you can actually hear a large amount of excerpts from the original recordings of the Roe oral arguments. And
yes,
when you listen to that, after a while, it becomes clear that Sarah Weddington was really prepared for any question that was going to be thrown her way. And unfortunately, the attorneys on the other side who were arguing for the pro-life position just were not as well prepared. They didn't understand why the laws came on the books, so they didn't have a rebuttal to Sarah Weddington's narration of that.
Mm.
And she was just, you know, on the top of her game, really.
Right. Well, so, and didn't she sort of stand on Griswold v. Connecticut and on the whole right of privacy issue?
Yes, and that had just come down a few years earlier. So this concept of privacy, again, there are half-truths through all of this. And I think most people would say that To a large extent, privacy is a good thing. I mean, we should be left alone. We shouldn't be interfered with by the government unless we're doing something wrong.
Right. Yeah.
unless there's some compelling interest, unless there's some reason why the government should interfere in our privacy. Well, the Griswold decision basically said that a married couple has the right to be let alone when it comes to making decisions about birth control, whether or not they want to use birth control. And so I believe that was 1968 is when that came down. So it was just a few years before Roe v. Wade was argued.
Right.
And so they built on this right of privacy, which had been established just a few years earlier by the Supreme Court, in order to say that now a woman, we believe, you know, the pro-choice position believes that the woman should have this privacy right extended to her decision whether or not to have an abortion.
Okay, so that, yeah, it came at a time that ended up working out well for the Sarah Weddington side. When you look
right
at the arguments, and you're right, people can listen to the audio from the actual arguments. When you listen to the justices now, and when you see the reactions or listen to the reactions now, obviously there were dissenters, including William Rehnquist, but what stands out for you in the big picture on the response from the justices? What swayed them and what made them decide the way they did?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. You know, trying to get inside their minds, I can't read their minds, but Justice White and his dissent, I think, really did justice to the pro-life cause. But aside from that, they really didn't focus on the issue of life, on the question of life. It came down to personhood, again, which I argue in the book is just a false premise that facilitates the pro-choice desire for abortion. If we center on this idea of personhood, what is a person? When does one become a person? Is it even possible to separate personhood from a living human being? Can you have a living human being who is not a person? Well, the Supreme Court obviously said that you could, but that's debatable. That's questionable. It's philosophical. It's not scientific. But if we were to focus instead on when human life actually begins, there's no question about that.
Yes.
That's scientific. That can be observed and have been observed, you know, many times over. Human life unquestionably begins at fertilization,
right,
at conception. From that point on, you have a living human being, and abortion kills that life. Now, whether it kills a person or not, that's highly debatable, and I argue that it's just it's not even a valid way to evaluate the morality of abortion. But that's what the Supreme Court focused on, was whether or not the fetus was a person. And because the debate centered on personhood, then they were able to say, we don't believe that the 14th Amendment, which was a key amendment that, you know, they were basing this ruling on, we don't believe that the word person, as used in the 14th Amendment, can refer to the unborn.
Wow.
And because of that, then we believe that abortion is acceptable, and they implemented it from that point on.
What was the reaction, Roger, when the decision first came down? There are a lot of pro-life activists today, the veterans, who will look back and say there wasn't really much of a reverberation at all initially. There weren't very many. You know, Joe Scheidler was one of the early pro-life activists. But generally speaking, did the country realize what a watershed moment that was, that Roe v. Wade had been handed down as it had?
I don't think so. I was kind of young at the time myself as well. But I don't believe there was a huge backlash. Part of what you had going on was Watergate was developing at that point. And
yes.
Also, Lyndon Johnson died on the same day that the Roe ruling was handed down. And that news story kind of overshadowed, you know, the news about Roe. So I think it kind of snuck up on a lot of people. And again, from the pro-life side, I really think that they underestimated Sarah Weddington, and they weren't expecting the ruling to come down as it did. And I think it took a little while to absorb what had actually happened.
Right. Well, and the Doe v. Bolton case came out simultaneously, and they were, and this was striking down the Georgia abortion law.
Right, and that focused on health. That in that ruling, health of the mother was defined very broadly. I don't remember the exact phrase, but it included mental health. It included, you know, anguish, this type of thing, so that it could be defined so broadly that a woman could say, I'm in distress if I'm going to have to continue with this pregnancy, and therefore, you know, abortion should be allowed. Because it's my mental health is going to suffer because of it. So it defined health so broadly that it really just allowed abortion for any reason.
Sure. Now, when you look back, and I know this is a big question, but we unfortunately don't have a whole lot of time, but when you look back at everything that has happened in the last 43 years with the abortion fight and all of the progress the pro-life community has made, do you believe that Roe v. Wade argued today could have yielded the same result given things like 3D imaging and sonograms and the rest?
If those factors would have been able to be employed by the pro-life side, I think the outcome would have been substantially different. Obviously I can't say specifically how it would have been different or which justice might have been swayed one way or the other. But obviously, when you look at the case and how it was actually argued, there was a huge deficiency on the pro-life side. Basically, the attorneys for the pro-life position said, you know, the state of Texas believes that a fetus is a person, and even that is not accurate. You should say a human being is a person.
I love that. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a great book, compelling interest, the real story behind Roe v. Wade, Roger Ressler. Roger, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be right back on Janet Meffer Today. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number is 800-793-8752. That's 800-793-8752 or trinitycredit.org. This hour of Janet Meffer Today is brought to you by Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit organization that helps people struggling with credit card debt. Their number, 800-793-8752, 800-793-8752, or trinitycredit.org. Well, it is the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. It's just unbelievable that it's been 45 years, 45 years too many, absolutely. And some things never change, like the media. How surprised would you be if I told you that for the second year, the networks covered the Women's March more than they covered the March for Life? You wouldn't be surprised at all. This wouldn't shock you at all. You'd say, of course they did that. They probably way undercounted the number of marchers who descended upon the nation's capital in such a way. Really, it was a historic March for Life this year because for the very first time, a sitting U.S. president addressed the marchers. And I thought that was so powerful that President Trump was willing to address the marchers. That shouldn't have taken 45 years either. But I want to give you an example here. Newsbusters covers this. During their Saturday news shows, the first evening of the Women's March, ABC, CBS, and NBC spent a total of 6 minutes, 43 seconds highlighting the event. Now, that might not seem like a lot of time, but that's actually a ton of time when it comes to TV airtime on one story over the three networks. By comparison, following the March for Life on Friday, the three broadcast networks spent just 2 minutes 6 seconds on the March for Life. I guess some women matter more than other women, right? Because you had thousands and thousands and thousands of women, young and old, and men, there at the March for Life standing for preborn babies and their right to life. I guess their perspective is not as important as the uber feminist screaming progressives of the Women's March. But I want to give you an example of what I'm talking about. NBC covered the March for Life this way, and just listen for all of the little innuendos. Listen to cut one.
President Trump beamed into the March for Life rally by satellite from the Rose Garden, the event just blocks away from the White House.
The March for Life is a movement born out of love.
Celebrated by marchers energizing his conservative base.
I just think it's amazing that we have a president who stands up for life.
For Joanne Bilduff, whose daughter Katie was adopted, today is personal.
Abortion is not the answer. We have adoption.
But the politics also loomed large. As a businessman, Mr. Trump supported abortion rights, but ran as an anti-abortion Republican candidate. Once in the Oval Office, he's touted some victories for the movement, like nominating conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. But other campaign promises have lagged, like his vow to defund Planned Parenthood and limit late-term abortions.
Why should anti-abortion supporters feel confident that President Trump is going to get some legislative victories?
The pro-life movement has seen a really great year of progress, making sure that our taxpayers are not footing the bill for abortions worldwide.
Tonight, abortion rights advocates say they're increasingly concerned. The president's chipping away at access to safe abortions, contraception, and women's rights.
We've seen this growing sense of need to stand up, need to use our voices.
But for those who march today, new momentum.
What kind of coverage is that? Well, that's exactly the sort of coverage you're going to get from a liberal network like NBC. So you spend a split second playing something from Trump's speech. Then you have references to energizing the conservative base, talk to a couple of people for a couple of seconds, and then morph into saying politics has loomed large, though, because Trump was once pro-choice. Irrelevant, isn't it? Actually, what you ought to be reporting, NBC, is the fact that it's an amazing turnaround for somebody who was very pro-choice and now has become the most pro-life president in American history. That's what a lot of the pro-life leaders are saying. And then, of course, you have to top it all off with a NARAL representative yelling about she's, you know, so concerned about access to safe abortions, as if there is such a thing. The language, everything, the way it's framed, the way you always have to get a pro-abort quoted multiple times in a story that should be about the pro-life movement. And I wonder how many different clips we could pull on the Women's March that went to conservative women who said, this is awful. These women are obnoxious. I don't agree. Their positions are terrible. This is an embarrassment. These embarrassing costumes, all the rest. Do you think they ever do that? Not that I've seen. So I want to play a little bit of what President Trump had to say, because I think this is very significant. This was what he said to the marchers. This is cut two.
Today, tens of thousands of family students and patriots and really just great citizens gather here in our nation's capital. You come from many backgrounds, many places, but you all come for one beautiful cause: to build a society where life is celebrated, protected, and cherished. The March for Life is a movement born out of love. You love your families, you love your neighbors, you love our nation, and you love every child, born and unborn, because you believe that every life is sacred, that every child is a precious gift from God.
Well, that didn't all end up on NBC Nightly News, did it? The gift from God part, the love, just a little clip. You got to make sure you don't play too much where people get a broader sense of what the president is saying. I want to play this clip as well of the president talking about some of the pro-life measures that he's backed. This is quite significant because they highlighted in that NBC report what hasn't passed. He hasn't defunded Planned Parenthood. That's Congress's fault. And he hasn't been able to get the other abortion measure passed, the one they referenced. Come on, we're talking about Congress. This is not something that Trump can do unilaterally. He's not Obama. Not that Obama would do that unilaterally, but other things he certainly would. So I want to play for you what President Trump said about some of the pro-life action he's already been able to get done. This is cut four.
And during my first week in office, I reinstated a policy first put in place by President Ronald Reagan, the Mexico City policy. I strongly supported the House of Representatives' pain-capable bill, which would end painful late-term abortions nationwide. And I call upon the Senate to pass this important law and send it to my desk for signing. On the National Day of Prayer, I signed an executive order to protect religious liberty. Very proud of that. Today, I'm announcing that we have just issued a new proposal to protect conscience rights and religious freedoms of doctors, nurses, and other medical professionals. So important. I have also just reversed the previous administration's policy that restricted states' efforts to direct Medicaid funding away from abortion facilities that violate the law.
So fantastic. And the last two that he mentioned were things that have just been done. This is all great news. And he referenced the late-term abortion measure that has not been able to get through the Senate. That's the Senate's fault. Come on, Mitch McConnell, get off the dime and get it done. Well, I do have to give credit where credit is due. The House voted on Friday to protect babies who survive botched abortions. It's called the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, or H.R. 4712. And they did this on the day of the March for Life on purpose. They stayed in session in order to be there on the day of the March for Life, which shows you the momentum of the pro-life movement and how it is becoming less and less possible for Congress, especially a Republican-controlled Congress or a Republican president, to ignore the pro-life movement. It's just too strong and too broad, and there are too many people doing too many things to push the government in the right direction. The bill requires that living babies have to be transported to a hospital for care if they're born alive after a botched abortion, instead of being left to the devices of the abortionist. This is via LifeSite News. And the bill also establishes penalties if health professionals do not provide this level of care. It also allows the mother to sue if her living baby is killed by intent or neglect. There are U.S. cases of babies, by the way, who have been born alive after botched abortions and then were brutally killed by the abortionist. Kermit Gosnell, remember him? In 2013, there was testimony that he killed at least 10 babies who were born alive by slitting their spinal cords. It's just sickening. It's grotesque. And it's so important that this legislation get all the way through Congress, that it get through the Senate. And it really needs to happen as quickly as possible. The Heartbeat Protection Act could be next. Let's get it all through. Keep pushing, keep calling, keep writing your congressman, keep writing your senators. We're going to continue to push for the sanctity of human life in the United States of America until the day, Lord willing, that Roe v. Wade is overturned. We'll come back on Janet Mefford Today after this. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here is Ann's story.
I had numerous credit cards and I was struggling with paying them off. I had heard about Trinity, so I made the call. They took care of all of my credit cards and now I am completely debt-free. The people at Trinity are very friendly. They will do whatever you need them to do in order for you to feel better about being in a very difficult place. My name is Anne, and thanks to Trinity, I'm debt-free for keeps.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your account, put a stop to late fees, and drastically reduce your interest. There is hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and we're partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to save babies' lives through ultrasound. Here's how a nurse describes the power of an ultrasound.
Last week, just one example of a mom who came in was very abortion-minded, and when she saw the picture of her baby on ultrasound and saw that beating heart, it was a defining moment that just broke her, and she said, I just can't allow this baby to be killed, were her own words.
By letting a mother hear her baby's heartbeat and see her baby in her womb, she will choose life 80% of the time.
I cannot tell you how many times a baby's life is saved through ultrasound. It's just an incredible tool.
Will you help save babies' lives? For $140, you can sponsor free ultrasounds for 5 young women. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229. Or give securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com. We're back on Janet Mefford today. So glad to have you here. And I'm going to tell you about an interesting scenario. Maybe that's not the right way to put it. But just in time for Christmas break, and the news is just now coming out, there's a high school in Falls Church, Virginia, by the name of George Mason High School, that held a school assembly with a special guest speaker. Her name is Amy Ellis Nutt. She's the Washington Post columnist, author, and Pulitzer Prize winner. And she arrived to lecture the children on a number of subjects, not the least of which was transgender issues, because she's the author of a book called Becoming Nicole, The Transformation of an American Family. Now, Kathy Ruse writes over at the Daily Signal all about this public school assembly that tells kids that sex changes are perfectly normal. But it just takes you back, doesn't it, to 20 years ago, and you would have pro-family and Christian activists raising the red flag and saying, listen, we can't go in this direction of homosexual rights, because if we do, it's going to end up in the schools. They're going to end up teaching our children that wrong is right and right is wrong and get them all mixed. Oh, no, we're not targeting the children. What are you talking about? You guys are all a bunch of nuts. How can you even talk that way? Well, okay, let me let you listen to what Amy Ellis Nutt had to say to these kids. And by the way, as they point out here, Kathy Ruse points this out, did the school make plain to the students that they didn't have to attend? It's not clear, but at the end of this presentation, Amy Ellis Nutt said, thank you for coming, although I know you're probably required to be here. It's also not clear whether parents were fully informed about the assembly in advance, but at least one shocked George Mason teacher, who remains anonymous, says parents were not fully informed about what she was about to say. So let's dive into what she said, shall we? Here's Amy Ellis Nutt. This is Cut 5.
Cisgender is a straightforward antonym of transgender. That is, its opposite. Both share the same root, gender, which comes from the Latin genus, meaning kind or type. The Latin trans means across, beyond, or on the other side. Cis in Latin means on this side of, or in the case of cisgender, self-identifying with the gender that conforms to your biological sex at birth. The point is, we all need to get comfortable with a new language. Not only the word transgender, but cisgender, and a lot of others that are actually changing every day. Because language matters. Because it's the best way of communicating. But what's also important, and the point I've been circuitously trying to get to, is that no matter how or what you looked like when you were born, no matter what gender identity you now embrace or sexual orientation you ascribe to, this one thing is true for all and everyone. Your biggest sex organ is your brain. I'm not trying to be funny. I'm trying to be factual. Everything to do with how you present yourself to the world, what genitals you have, what reproductive organs you have, what gender you identify, and who you're sexually attracted to was imprinted in your brain by way of two things, hormones and genes, when you were still in your mother's womb.
Okay, is this woman a doctor? Is this woman some sort of an expert on these things? She works for the Washington Post covering health and science, but that doesn't make her a scientist, and it doesn't make her some sort of a medical professional who can speak this way. And by the way, in case you were wondering, cisgender means normal. Normal. That's what cisgender means, that you were born a girl and you identify as a girl. Well, of course you identify as a girl. You're a girl. Again, we're back to this Gnostic impulse that we talked about recently with Nancy Piercy. My body doesn't matter. I can be something different than my body is telling me. Are you nuts? And when she tells these kids, think about this for a moment. She's not addressing just an adult audience. This is mainly kids. And she's saying we all need to get comfortable with a new language. I want to add on to that because homosexual activists and progressives say you better. That's what she's really saying. We've decided this is the way we're going to go, and you better all get on board. Or else what, Amy Ellisnot? What are you going to do if we maintain reality and we say that you all are crazy? Because that's what it is. I'm just saying it because it's so frustrating to listen to this and so maddening, especially if I had been a parent of one of those kids. Are you kidding me? I hope these parents are storming the gates against these administrative officials. All right, now listen to this. She says that basically sex and gender are totally different things. Listen to cut six.
So to sum up, sex and gender are two separate things, and they can be categorized in four ways. First, there's biological sex, refers, again, to your genitals, reproductive organs. Then there's gender expression, refers to how you dress, wear your hair, how you act. These things, unlike biological sex, are prone to cultural shifts and changes over the years. For instance, today we traditionally assign blue to boys at birth and pink to girls. But 100 years ago, it was just the opposite. Pink was seen as a variant of red, and red was considered a strong, manly color, whereas blue was thought to be delicate and dainty, and therefore more suitable for girls.
So what? I mean, what does it matter if blue used to be more applied to girls and pink was more on the red spectrum and was considered more of a boy? So what? You're born female or male. It's not difficult. And you can only make it difficult if you've gotten on the homosexual activist bandwagon and you're determined to turn us all Gnostic, because that's what it is. Now on to gender identity and sexual orientation. And listen up, kids, for this completely inappropriate section of my speech. Cut seven.
The third aspect is gender identity. Obviously refers to the gender you know you are, which is not aligned with the biological sex at birth. And fourth, sexual orientation, which someone once delineated from gender identity in this way. Gender is who you go to bed as. Sexual orientation is who you go to bed with. All of which is to say, gender is not a choice. In the same way that it's not a choice you were born with blue eyes or blonde hair. It is a choice to say or advocate a view or enact laws that codify that view, which discriminate against transgender people.
Again, what is she talking about? And why are you talking about who you go to bed with to a whole assembly of kids? Why are you discussing this? And why aren't any teachers or administrators standing up, walking over to her, taking her up by the scruff of her sweater and hauling her off stage and say, you're not going to talk to kids about this stuff? Clearly, they're on board with it and they think it's perfectly fine. Now we get to the part of her speech where she tells the kids that they're all basically animals like the Maury eel. Listen to cut eight.
All of these characteristics of male and female are averages. A few years ago, scientists looked at brain scans of men and women and discovered that most were a mosaic, an amalgamation of typically male and typically female structures. In fact, only 8% contained entirely male or entirely female structures. In other words, the rest of the brains fell on a spectrum. And that's what we do now. It's no one thing. It's not binary. It isn't for animals either. Moray eels and gobies change sex. When the sole male in a school of reef fish dies, the largest female becomes aggressive and begins to produce sperm. So gender is complicated. Our brains, of course, look for quick solutions and easy answers. When faced with people or situations or ideas that are difficult to understand, they go for what's simplest. That's just how our brains were built, and it's our evolutionary legacy. But concepts like being transgender are not quick or easy to understand. So we have to resist our brains jumping to conclusions, adopting hard and fast positions about right and wrong, normal and abnormal. These are things we are all still learning.
Okay, gender is complicated. Well, right, because you're making it complicated. Biological sex is actually extremely easy. You're a boy or you're a girl. And in a minute portion of the population, you might have people who are hermaphrodites. And that's a different scenario, but that's an extremely small number of people in the population, intersex. Other than that, you have the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the fifth edition, says as many as 98% of boys and 88% of girls will grow out of their gender dysphoria and accept their biological sex after naturally passing through puberty. So I don't see her bringing that up. And when it comes to eels, as Hot Air points out, telling children that sex change is perfectly normal because moray eels and reef fish do it is a disingenuous partisan mixture of science and fantasy. It's true that a significant number of creatures are classified as sequential hermaphrodites, but they're found exclusively among fish, a few frogs, and gastropods. In the absence of one gender in a given population, these creatures evolved to be able to switch from male to female or from female to male in order to continue to procreate. But here's the thing. This trait doesn't exist in human beings. Again, not a medical professional, not a scientist. She's a Washington Post writer. Incredible. I hope these parents do the right thing and hold this school accountable, because that is just child abuse. Sorry, but that's the way it is. Camille Pagley and I agree totally on that. It's child abuse. All right, we got to go. Thanks a lot for listening. We really appreciate your tuning in, and we'll see you next time here on Janet Meffer Today.